Well, good evening and welcome to the latest Director's Dialogue. And first of all, thanks to the Business Society and to the Music Business Society for helping to organise it this evening. And congratulations to everybody who's decided to come out in the cold, because it is really rather unpleasant out there at the moment. But particularly, welcome to Rolf Schmidt-Holtz. And the way these things operate, for those who haven't been to one before, is I ask a few questions to get things going, but I will throw it open after 20 minutes or so to the audience. We never have any problem with questions, but if we do, I shall ask you to. So you better get thinking. Delighted to have Rolf with us. As you can see, he is chairman of Bertelsmann, so well, Sony BMG, but his career has been a very varied one. He began as a lawyer in the University of Kiel. That's no surprise. Almost all Germans are lawyers at some point in their lives. And then in his early career was, in fact, a journalist for the most part. We're running a political television show, was publisher and editor of Stern for a while, and then moved into the publishing and the music publishing part of the great Bertelsmann empire. And now divides his time between New York and Hamburg as chairman of Sony BMG. Now, we always like to start these with some questions to make our guests feel at home. So let's begin by asking why CDs are so expensive.
Because, you know, as you know, the music industry, it's not an industry really, it's a business. And we like this stretch limo culture, you know. We are all egomaniacs, and we are only happy if we have at least 5 cars and 10 houses and being divorced 3 times, which is very expensive. So therefore, we need just to collect money. From who should we do it? We don't spend, you know. We only grab it. And we do it from you, and we feel $15 is not enough. And by the way, in Japan, for example, we get more for a CD.
But more seriously, if I but because I'm sure someone else will ask one about CD. I mean, I think that the interesting and sort of perplexing question that many people have about the music business now, and this may be relevant to those who are interested in going in it, is that in an internet age, an MP3, iPod age, how do you, in future, secure your revenues? I mean, it seems like at the moment it's optional as to whether you want to pay for music or not. You seem to be able to, and every time a Napster is closed down or sued, you know, another one opens up. So how do you see the economics of the music business developing? Where are you going to get your revenues from?
I feel terrible because you want me to be serious, okay?
You're German.
No, Germans are not serious. They are stubborn, you know. But they play quite well soccer, you know, I tell you. So, do I have 4 minutes?
Yeah, at least.
If we go back to the history of the music business came out of bars, was linked to crime, alcohol, was sometimes illegal, was not very much liked, which is okay. Then it developed, and it was growing like hell. In these times, and this is why I have to refer on the history a bit, you could be lucky if you had one hit, one song. You was a rich man. Either when you wrote the song or when you recorded and performed, basically one hit made your life. And when you was lucky, you was a star or at least a bit rich. In a growing business, fantastic, you know. This created an environment where really nobody cared about costs or revenues or the normal course of business. It was just fun, you know. And if you was not lucky, okay, at least you was in a nice environment. So looking at 1999, for example, only 7 years back, when the decline, the sharp decline of the industry started off, if you had made, because you are so intelligent, an analysis about the music industry, you would say, what the hell? They don't have standards, really. They don't behave like an industry. It's all by accident. They are all really egomaniacs, which is, by the way, not only bad. They are really very much selfish. And this is not an industry I would put my money in. Therefore, this industry didn't think of prices for CDs. They didn't think of revenues in the future. They didn't care about digital. This is the reason why the music industry did not invent iPod and iTunes. It was Apple who basically, Steve Jobs. So like the guys who invented the carriages in the beginning of this the last century, they didn't care about cars or trains. They said carriages will last forever. And so the music industry thought, oh, vinyl is over, okay, but now we have CDs, it will last forever. Great prices, fantastic. They didn't care about online distribution, really. And therefore, the question, where does in the future the revenues, where do the revenues come in the future? There are two main areas. One is anywhere digital, including mobile. But we have now a growing area of platforms. It's not only iTunes anymore. It's a lot of platforms, and they are growing, including mobile. By the way, it's sharply increasing, but it's not yet compensating the decrease of the CD sales. It's not yet balanced, but it's, you know, we are on our way to balance it. But it's not enough. There's another area which is very interesting and for us very serious. This means, this is an area, how to describe to you, we are not part of all the bits and pieces of the value chain of an artist. What do I mean by this? The music industry, at least we feel, we produce a brand. Let's take an example, Britney Spears, okay? Samba Records invented Britney. They made Britney, together with Britney, obviously, and they created a brand. If you would now total the revenues of Britney, I know the revenues, therefore I don't tell you, but let's assume 100, right? You would see that Britney only makes 25 out of CD sales. 75 she makes out of advertising, sponsorship, concerts. We are not part of it. So I feel it's not okay that the industry, who creates at least together with an artist a brand with our marketing money, with our promotion activities, we are not part of these kind of revenues. And if you remember, at least the members of the business music music business society here would remember the deal EMI made with Robbie Williams included these bits and pieces of his revenue stream. So two areas, digital, including mobile, and part of the value chains a brand like an artist creates. This is where the revenues will come from in the future. Sorry for being a little bit long, but it makes sense in the context, I think.
Now, does that have any implications for the type of people you need in the business if you are managing this kind of broader spectrum of the Britney brand or whoever?
This will be, it's for me, it's a key question and our key challenge. It's people. When we talk about music industry being a people business, you know, this is the common saying, we are people business. What does it mean? We are paid to run successfully creative processes. So we have to convince a creative genius, or at least a creative human being, to transform emotion and creativity into economical success. This is quite difficult. And you have to do it on a regular basis. because the shareholders unfortunately expect results every other year. So you can tell them it's a volatile business, and you know, the girl doesn't like to sing this year, she wants to sing next year, and you know, the guy is in love, and you know, the other girl is pregnant. They don't care. They don't really care. They want to have EBIT on EBITDA and all this stuff. So what we need are people who are able to run those businesses / other people. Therefore, we are not looking for managers, really. We are looking for entrepreneurs. We want to have real people. What does it mean being an entrepreneur? It means you have to cope with everything, with every part of a business. It's not only legal and finance and production and marketing and promotion. It's about everything. You have to care about the artists. You have to care about the management and all the stuff around. This is quite demanding. And therefore, and I'm sitting here in the LSE, it's not enough to be intelligent. It's okay. it's excellent, but it's by far not enough. To lead, to motivate, to foster group of people, you need more. And these guys who have more, we are interested in. And the happiest moment in an entrepreneurial life is if you find somebody like this. Because if you make mistakes in this area, it's a disaster. It's very costly. It's very dangerous. And it can, by the way, destroy a company. And I can prove it. It's not a saying. If you have the wrong CEO at the top of a creative company, you can destroy the company within only 2 years. By behavior, by arrogance, by, you know, just personal and character shortcomings. I can prove it. Give you an example which happened in our... You just stop me if I'm too long. One of our CEOs once met the Backstreet Boys when they were before their top. And he was not the CEO, therefore I can tell the story. He was an arrogant asshole. He met these guys.
It's German.
He went. He was not German.
No, I thought the phrase was German. I was trying.
Sorry. How would you say it better than I do? He was an arrogant.
Yes.
What?
Asshole is fine.
Asshole is fine. And he told the guys, I listened to your last record, you know, I didn't like it really, and I think the time for boy groups, it's over. It was one sentence of this arrogant guy. This group stood up, left the room, went to another label, and made a fortune. We lost the group, we lost another group, because they told another group about this behavior. We lost only, for this one sentence, about 500 millions in, not revenues, in EBIT, which is a disaster. So that means we are looking for excellent people, and this is not only formal intelligence, marks and certificates, this is basically a broader range of personality.
So where do you recruit from?
I shouldn't say it. Do you insist?
Yes.
So, we start again. We start again to recruit from Oxford, Harvard, LSE, but we stopped it for a couple of years. I stopped it personally. And I give you the reason. We made the experience that 90% of these guys we have recruited and we have hired failed. Not because they were not smart enough. They were over average at the top. But the internal behavior was really basically quite arrogant. They were embarrassed that they were not CEOs with 28, you know. The personal expectation about career was so strong It was so distracting from what they should do really that they just couldn't cope with that. And this led to a situation where they couldn't integrate in teams really. Nobody asked for them. Nobody liked them really. Nobody said, where is he or she? And this is a situation where I really would like to tell you more about it, because this is crucial for your life wherever you are. It's not only in the music business. It's everywhere. If you fail in this area, you fail anyway. You will fail totally, because we don't like these guys who basically are so proud of what they have done in university. We want to have leaders who bring other people together and really care about them. At the end, if you are at the Piccadilly Circus and you have to care about 50 people, you are a leader if you bring these 50 people, if you say now across the place, and all the 50 arrive at the other end. This is leadership. And this is not about formal intelligence and intellectual capacity. It's more. It's really character and personality. And this is what we were looking for. So now, why did we start again to recruit it? Because we really feel the people in the generation have changed. We see now when we recruit in Harvard or here in Great Britain, we see that more people understand that a people business or an entrepreneur needs to have a total variety of talent. You probably mean, oh, he's talking about the soft skill shit, and we always read it, you know, the social intelligence. I hate it, by the way. I hate social competence. I hate social intelligence, because the misunderstanding is that a lot of students mean it's enough to read a book about it and I have it. It's not. It's not enough to have a beer with somebody else and say, oh, I was, yesterday night, I was socially competent, you know. basically, you probably cannot learn it in universities. If you have not grabbed it on the knees of your mother or father or amongst your friends or as a scout or, you know, with real people, you will have big difficulties to learn it when you are 30. Therefore, I encourage you, how old you are, doesn't matter. Start to meet people. Not start to meet yourself and your peer group. It's not interesting. Start to meet real people. Start to care about it. Who of you visited an average British family in the last 2 years, in an average apartment? Are you sure? Five? Six? Okay, seven. Seven is good.
Yeah, we don't live in apartments, that's the thing.
Or house, or whatever. So, the case of beer is under the cupboard, you know. The jogging pants and the mother are in the kitchen. The parents are shouting to each other. They don't communicate. They don't have any money. And they bring up children. So this is our audience. This is the people we are producing music and television and media for it. And please care about these people. Don't be arrogant about these people. They really deserve respect, because they don't have the privilege to sit at LSE and think about career. They have to make their life on a by far more difficult basis. So if you are not able to understand what I'm talking now, you're not able to lead people. Because in a company, you have a lot of those people. You not only care about your board and some executives, you have thousands of real people. You lay off people. You better care if you lay off people. You hire people. And these people smell whether you care about them. They smell whether you are honest or not. They smell whether you want to run the company for the profit of the shareholder or whether you really want to be successful together with these guys. So therefore, I really encourage you, think about that, because if your lack of this kind of interest for people, if your lack of these skills, people smell it. Therefore, if you make statistics, you probably do. Why are not 90% of the alumni of Harvard CEOs or CFOs or members of the board? Why? Because they lack exactly what I told you. And people realize in real life, and they don't follow these people anymore. They don't know why. They probably cannot explain why, but they wouldn't do it. They know it's wrong. It's not honest. It's not real.
I'm going to throw it open in just a second, but let me just ask one more question. You talk about the skills you look for, the people skills, but you recruit in the US, you recruit in Germany and in the UK. Do you identify any national differences or differences in the way universities are producing people in those three countries?
Yeah. First of all, the worst is Germany. Unfortunately, it is. Because we don't have a culture of private schools. Not at all, but nearly not. It means we have a very good public school system, by the way. In average, it's better than the British one. But we don't have we nearly don't have elite universities or elite schools. It's not our thinking. It's a very social democratic culture thinking. You know, it's boring, it's equalizing, it's not motivating. If I would like to describe the German school system and compare it with the English one, I would say the German teacher is happy if he proves to the kids that he are stupid enough, even when he explains three times. Then he's happy. I told you three times, you're still not able to repeat. Fine. Great teacher. The British teacher probably would say, come on, you can't do that. Listen again, you will do that. It's just another approach, you know. It's maybe the same stupid student, but it's by far more. No, it's not true. So you have also German teachers here? And the American teacher would say, you are the greatest, you are fantastic, you're a hero. And unfortunately, the Americans believe it. And this is, by the way, only to be serious, a major difference in management. You'll really find a lot of American managers who are not only proud of what they're doing, they really think they are perfect. You cannot criticize them for that. They were brought up that way, you know. From 3 years on, they are just, you know, phenomenal. And if you try to tell them they are probably not, they just don't get it. They say, Rolf, you disrespect me. Okay. Then I say, you better deliver, and then we talk, you know. That's
okay.
A difference, yeah.
Questions to you. Yeah, first one over here. If you could, the mics will come around. You can say who you are, that would be helpful.
Right. My name's Louise Ferguson. I'm actually an alien here. I'm chair of Open Rights Group. A couple of questions relating to DRM.
A couple?
They're related to each other.
One and one, you know, I cannot
okay.
grab them.
What lessons do you think the Arctic Monkeys phenomenon has for Sony BMG and other
which
major
phenomenon?
Labels? The Arctic Monkeys phenomenon.
Arctic Monkeys.
And the traditional business model in the music industry. And would you like to elaborate on Sony's future DRM strategy in the wake of the great Rootkit debacle?
Yeah. So let's start with the Rootkit debacle. It was an XCP protection debacle. We had, first of all, in a very formal sense, a chairman of a board of a company never talks about operational issues. He's just forbidden to do it. So, but I don't want to not answer you the question. I give you basically my personal view. First of all, there is no doubt we have to fight piracy and file sharing. No doubt about that. And we will continue to do that. Why? First of all, it's theft, full stop. And secondly, we owe it to our artists and songwriters. And please take it seriously. It's not the Britney Spears of this world and the multimillionaires we are talking about. It's a large part of people living and make their living from the music they are writing, they're producing, and they're performing. And if you steal them the money, you basically get cut off the new generation of music. This is very serious. We don't do that. So in order to fight piracy, in order to fight it, you also make mistakes. So you go to a company and you ask for a software in order to only allow copying of CDs, I don't know, 7 times and file sharing of a CD 10 times. Fine. So this software fails. You don't realize, you make a lot of market research, you check it with engineers, you check it with other software firms, you don't find out. And then you implement it in the market, and the first blogger after 2 weeks tells you, oh, this is a rootkit, it basically disturbs my computer. So Sony BMG never wanted to do it. It was never a spy software. It was just a failure. And then it's about reacting. How do you react? First of all, the critics say, we reacted too late. Okay, fine, you can argue about that. Maybe with the benefit of hindsight, we probably did. Then we took all the CDs out of the market. We offered to the customers new CDs. We delivered an anti-piracy program in order to repair it. And we paid fees to general attorneys and so on in order to settle lawsuits. Very costly, a tragedy for image and so on and so on. But this is what happens. And unfortunately, I tell you, you can't exclude it. Even when you are very careful, even when you talk to 5 experts and engineers, you just cannot avoid it. Now we are obviously by far more cautious and careful, but again, I cannot guarantee you that mistakes in software or technique never happen. But we are aware of it, and obviously the best way to fight piracy is to offer attractive, legal file sharing stuff. This is what we have to do for a reasonable price and with an attractive package. This is the best way to do it, and this is where we're focusing on.
Next.
Yeah.
Off the back of that, I wanted to ask a question about, I mean, it was great hearing you talk about, you know, the kind of normal people in their flats, kind of, you know, have we actually visited these people? But I'm also wondering, well, you say you want to stomp out piracy, but it's the normal everyday people that are also your pirates. And so I wonder about how much respect you have for the normal everyday people, you know, the people that are in the flats, you know, copying music for their friends. And, you know, do you have a duty to think about your customers even more so than maybe your the people on your books?
It's acoustically very difficult. Your question is whether we have the same duty to our customers than we have to our artists and the business, right?
Yeah.
Talk about stomping out piracy, and the younger generation, they've grown up, you know, they want to be able to remix music, they want to be able to share music. So the next generation, this will be the way that things are. And you're talking about stomping out piracy, and I'm wondering, the conflict.
Yeah. I agree with you. Obviously, we are interested to deliver any kind of music to everybody and to enable people to mix or to share or whatever. But we cannot live with the idea that it's for nothing. We can't do that because we destroy a business. Look, it's not the greedy majors want to make money. They are always greedy, want to make money. Everybody wants to make it. But it's not about this. Let's talk about figures here. If the music industry declines by 8%, it means at the moment that a major like Universal, maybe not Universal, but a major like Sony BMG just disappears in 1 year's time, you can say, okay, Sony BMG, I don't care. I'm not talking about Sony BMG. A music major of a size of over 4 billion revenue disappears. So if we continue to do business like this, we destroy 60 to 70% of the creativity of the music. You will only have mainstream pop in a couple of years. You don't have classics anymore because we don't make money. You don't have jazz anymore because we don't make money with that. I tell you what, it's serious. It's not only because we like to make money. We destroy a broader range of creativity in the music business. And if you talk to people who are not superstars, they are already terribly affected. And if you have in mind, last remark, if you have in mind that some artists only have a life circle of success of about, let's say, 10 years, not every artist performs from 16 to 70. So you know what we are talking about. We better take it seriously. But again, legal offers to the audience is the best we can do, and we are working on it. Here.
Hi. Question, is it possible, and has Sony BMG looked at fear of piracy as an opportunity to create revenue? I know there are some institutions in the U.S. I believe Cornell puts some sort of minimal fee into tuition, and Duke does something similar because they are particularly afraid of their students being prosecuted for piracy. So are there ways to turn the course of events to your benefit?
There are ways, very difficult, and they don't matter at the end, you know. It's so low revenues, it's not a way to save our to solve our problems. It's a little tiny part, but we have to care about everything. Wherever we can transform illegal stuff into, you know, legal use, we would do it.
Yeah, sorry, just one front row. You've had a go.
You were talking about artists' creativity beforehand, but isn't it also the case that the consolidation of the majors such as Bertelsmann Music Group and Sony drives out the smaller independent labels who are also responsible for a lot of the non-pop, non-mainstream creativity?
I disagree, and I would like to explain why, and you probably get it. There is no doubt that consolidation attacks also creativity. Why? Because if your revenues go down year by 8%, you have to do something. So you can lay off people, fine, but it's not enough. You also have to cut down artist roster. So you can afford for a couple of years to give young artists a chance because you can afford it. You can say, I believe in this artist, and if it's not next year, I just keep him in my roster. I basically support him, I pay him, because some point in time she or he will explode. Fine. You can't afford it if you don't have the money. So therefore, there are two effects. If the revenues go down by 8 or 10%, you have to cut your costs by at least 8 to 10%, even more. So one point is, again, to get rid of artists. It's no way around it. What it means to independent labels, they are also affected in general by the downturn of the music industry, not necessarily by the majors. They are always competing with us. But since they are more focused on the artist, they are more specialized. They are not like an industry. We are quite a big company. It's a little bit impersonal. It's not like loving and caring like a little tiny label, which can. They have very, very good opportunities and chances in niches, obviously, but they have it. And they still not only survive, they have a lot market share in this market. But our biggest enemy is, for everybody, including the tiny and nice labels, is the downturn of the revenues via file sharing and piracy. No doubt about that. And this affects everybody.
Yeah.
Hi there. It started in the USA. You start suing the middle family on their piracy and sharing the music. Now it started in the UK too. I think there was a case 1 week ago. I'm not sure if that's right. Do you think that this is going to have any effect on the piracy, suing the individual users that are sharing the software?
Yes, it has an effect, but it's basically not the way I like. If you threaten your customer instead of winning and embracing him, it's a little bit strange, you know? But we know, unfortunately we know, that suing people for individual abuse has a threatening effect, which is unfortunately the truth. It's in USA it's working. But in USA, you know, they're having huge fines, substantial ones, you know. It's about $500,000 sometimes, if they do it in an industrialized way. So it has an impact. I think it has a positive impact because it's a threatening effect, but it also has a negative impact because it's not the way to make business by threatening your potential customers. Therefore, I don't like it. Can we forget about it? I don't think so at the moment. I would love to. It already happens in Europe. It doesn't happen at all in Asia. So in Asia we have great printing plants which produce CDs. We know that. The government knows about it. They promise us we stop it. They never stop it. It's an industry. No. It was in the newspapers that they would by copying they would give the data to the company. It's not true. They don't do that. It was not our intention, and it didn't happen. But it was a blog. No, you find out with police. They offer this. These burn CDs, they sell it, you find out. You don't need to have data collected by during the process of burning. You find out in a normal way. So we don't have data from people who burn, let's say, our CDs. We don't have it.
You've had five goes. You've been talking about this problem as a sort of problem that the industry has to deal with. Is there any public policy solution to this? Is there anything that governments could do to kind of establish a new equilibrium, if you like, in this marketplace?
Yes, obviously there is a way, and this is to fight piracy with law. This is what they're doing. It took us a while to convince the politicians that we need this law, because they said, oh, it's an entertainment business, why should we go against our customers, because your customers are our voters. Why should we fight our voters? So therefore, it took them a long time to understand that it was necessary. And only when the movie industry started to get the same issue, the same problems, so in America especially, the politicians said, oh, if Hollywood is in danger, we better care. So therefore, we benefited a bit from the movie picture, the movie business, because it was a risk that if the movie business is affected the same way the music business is affected, it would have a major negative impact in Hollywood. So this is the normal legal way to fight it. And then you need, obviously, prosecution and police to basically execute it. And this was what happens a bit in US. But it doesn't help. Again, it's a way to protect the interests of our artists, but it's not a solution.
Go on the second, middle of the second row, I've spotted you over there.
Okay. Hi, I just wanted to quickly ask you on one point you made earlier about the mobile aspect or the digital platforms and the mobile business. So how would you estimate the future of the, especially the digital platform, the mobile digital platform of distributed music, and what specifically would that mean in terms of maybe, I don't know, product ranges or ideas for the future? Thank you.
If I knew, I wouldn't sit here. I would be a rich kid and what's it in the Caribbean. Mobile is rapidly growing. And we see huge opportunities in mobile. But give you an example. That's the reason why I tell you I don't know. Would anybody of you have thought that ringtones would be a business? People pay for ringtones? Wait a second. $2 for a ringtone? It's a huge business. I didn't expect that. Did I talk to anybody who expected it? No. Nobody told me, Rolf, between us, ringtones. I would have said, yeah, okay, come on. So in the mobile world, there will be business we don't have even a clue today. It's word of mouth. It's what the kids like. It's basically what people create themselves. But mobile, you are available anytime, anywhere. It will be a huge business, no doubt about that. And at the moment, our business increases dramatically in mobile. But could you have the idea that after 5 years, mobile is out and another device we don't even think of today is in and probably has an, I don't know, ubiquity of everything? Could be. But one thing I'm sure of, music will stay in our life forever. And therefore, music always accompanied people. If you look back in your life, the most beautiful moments in your life were accompanied by music. And also the sad moments are accompanied. There is no life without music. If you read what poems and what professors of literature say, they would say, we love literature, we love lyrics, but we cannot live without music. And therefore, my basic conviction is, whatever the platform is, whatever the distribution is, at the end I don't care that much, as long as we produce the best and most attractive music. The content opens the ways, never the device. So, do you like to have a TV set in your apartment? No. It's rubbish. You don't need this box in your apartment. Nobody needs this crap. What you want to have is a movie and a James Bond or a penalty in soccer or a kiss after romance or something like that. This is why you have the TV set. What you really want to have is music, whether it's mobile or Walkman or I don't know, Dolby Surround, it doesn't matter at the end. And therefore, what we have to focus on is creativity. It's music. And this is why we will survive 100 years. We have not found the business model yet after the decades of CDs. Fine. We were spoiled. We were lazy. Not hungry enough. Not good. But we will survive. And there will be a time where music will be everywhere and bigger and more than today. Believe me. Don't ask me when.
Well, music always accompanies beautiful moments. Maybe we'll play it in the exams at the end of this year. But woman in the front row.
Why not? Yeah.
Good evening. I think sort of the general consensus amongst those who do steal music is that, as you were saying earlier, that you know they're not stealing from the little man on the street trying to make a dollar out of his songwriting or performing. They're stealing from the Britney Spears or the Archer sort of thing. And I think beyond the technological side of it, where you're employing preventative measures against piracy. I think there's an opportunity for governments and for record companies to sort of get a message across to the general public that, you know, to create a social conscience against this, that, you know, it's about saving the industry as a whole. It's about saving small artists. And I was just wondering sort of what sort of things, yeah, beyond the technological side of it, are you doing to kind of, you know, employ these sort of strategies?
Look, again, I think the music industry as a whole failed a bit in doing what you just described. And one part is that in the public awareness and perception, it's really, as you said, it's about the multi-billionaires. You know, it doesn't matter whether Britney has another Porsche or not, you know. But this is wrong. It's just wrong. But you don't get it across that easy. And people, you know, they don't say, I don't buy a Chelsea ticket because this one player gets 8 million. They buy it because they feel it's part of the game and come on, you know. And well, they just need it. But if they could burn a ticket, they would do that, you know. And therefore, the technology essentially changed social behavior. And it's very difficult to convince kids as a social common ground to not do it if you get it easily. It's just difficult. But I see you're very much interested in piracy and...
Mm. Who's got a question that isn't
and
about
stuff
piracy?
Like this.
Yeah, not about piracy, right.
What is your opinion of the emergence of Apple coming in as a sort of major player within the recording industry, where, say, 5 years ago, you would have never thought of a computer company even having any sort of function or influence? You notice how the major artists are primarily getting involved with Apple, for example, Alicia Keys, Kanye West, even Madonna recently putting her whole catalog online. What is stopping record labels from just copying the format of iTunes and maybe undercutting them and putting their own artist roster out to the general public, as opposed to sort of submitting themselves to Steve Jobs and Apple, sort of, you know, please put our catalog on your iTunes? I feel like he's in a sort of power-wielding position where he controls the final stage of, you know, getting the music out.
Yeah, first of all, he still is. You know, it will change a bit as because there will be a lot more platforms, not only iTunes, and there will be a competition, and this will be equalized over years. But your first question is interesting. So why didn't you do it? You know, you have the music. Why didn't you invent iTunes? The answer is we are incompetent in doing this. We're just not able to do it. A music company is focused on finding and developing artists. This is what we probably can. Hopefully we can do that. We are just incompetent and unable to develop direct-to-customer distribution business. We never did. We are so stupid in distribution, we are shipping the CDs to the Walmarts of this world, and that's it. And I tell you what, it's very difficult to create iTunes. There's only one guy in the world I know up to now who was successful. It's by the name of Steve Jobs. There were 15, at least 15 other approaches to do it. MusicNet and MusicLoad and Prezzo, all this stuff, all failed, by the way. It's not like this. And again, by the way, if you did it as Sony BMG, would you get the music from Warner's, EMI, and Universal, and for what price? And if you did it together, the antitrust authorities would come and say, you're not allowed to do that. So we are not in the platform distribution direct to end consumer business. We are just not. And therefore, if we had been smart enough, we would probably would have had the idea, but I'm afraid of, we would have not been able to execute it.
Okay. No.
No, it's not a cost issue, but it's a issue. It's interesting. It's a an issue of mixed calculation. Why did Steve Jobs invent iTunes? Because he wanted to sell iPods. So what did he make from iTunes? I tell you what, to generalize it, nothing. But he made $150 from every iPod. So if you don't have the device iPod, you don't make money out of iTunes or of MusicNet from Sony BMG. So this is a mixed calculation. This guy had a very attractive, sexy, cool device called iPod. And in order to support the revenues for iPod, he donated the oil, you know, to get the iPod burned. This is a mixed calculation. And, you know, we were just not able to create a device like an iPod.
Guy just behind, just there, that's it.
Good evening. If I may address you as Rolf and Howard. I'd like to first of all say thank you very much to Celine and the Music Society for organising this event. It's very reassuring to hear you, Ralph, talk about a slant slightly against elitism, and I respect that having done my first degree at Kiel. Now, you talked about the average Joe and people from a socioeconomic group D, E, so to speak. So please be kind enough to tell us what, and this isn't accusatory in any sense of the word, what is your organization doing about the average Joe and promoting creativity within the music industry for people from this section of society?
For people from?
D's and E's he was talking about. I mean, you know,
the average Joe, people who lives in an average apartment.
Yeah. We basically have, as Bertelsmann first and then at Sony BMG, a couple of programs. First of all, we have a Bertelsmann donation, the Bertelsmann Foundation, and this foundation pays money. Let me give an example in New York for, I would say, people in very poor social environment to teach them. We do it together. We teach them in music. We give we give instruments to these people, and we give teachers to teach music. We also teach them reading. We donate books because the publisher Random House is part of Bertelsmann, so we give books away and teach them to read. We make projects and program. I know best from New York. And we invite to contests. We encourage people to learn an instrument and to sing. That's basically it. But we do it, to give you an idea, we spend, as the Bertelsmann Foundation, 60 million euro, 60, every year for, let's say, for general social projects, including creativity, but it's only a part of it. We do it for medicine, we do it for environment, we do it for any kind of field we feel that's worthwhile. And we do it in a sense that we don't just give money, but we start projects with the idea that they can survive afterwards. So we want to seed something, and we don't want to only give away. Because we found out if you only donate, it's done, it's more or less over. But if you seed something and you give a start, and maybe over years you help, and you create a situation which can survive by itself, it's worthwhile.
We've got forest of hands. We haven't got that much time. But
if I can say one further thing just to address that point. I'm involved in a project called Food for All and Music for All. Now, I'm hoping that you'll be kind enough to give us your blessings and make the point to my peers here that we're based in King's Cross, and in relation to the subject of personalism, every Friday we get together and we allow people to bring all sorts of musical instruments and come jam with us. We provide free food, and any money we raise goes towards charity to provide food for the homeless people in London. It's 102 Caledonian Road. It's called Matchless Gifts. It's just around the corner from King's Cross. So if anybody wants to take the opportunity that yourself mentioned about meeting the average Joe from the average house, here's an opportunity to do so. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Great.
May I pay you first a lot of respect for this? Secondly, I would like to invite you to come to me afterwards, and let's talk.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Schmidt-Holz, you mentioned the average people in the average flat, and that's basically this is your, kind of your target audience, but also people that you have to care about. You also said that a lot of the moments in our lives we would connect or associate with certain types of music. Now, the issue of antisocial behavior is sometimes connected with certain types of music. I mean, it might differ and in a different context, but how do you bridge, or how do you find the balance between your responsibility that you have by producing music that might be associated with this type of behavior or might reinforce it, censorship, and at the same time maximizing profits in a sense for your shareholders? How do you bridge that gap?
This question applies to every kind of media. It applies to television, it applies to magazines, it applies to music. There is no rule, there is no recipe at all. There are two kinds of behavior which basically avoid that you go on a regular basis too far. It doesn't avoid mistakes. The one is you have to create an atmosphere in your company which makes you aware of it. That's the first thing. If you're a cynic and if you don't care, it's a disaster. But if you create an atmosphere of open discussion about it on a regular basis, means not on a regular meeting basis, but whenever it comes up, you have to take a decision. Then you avoid a lot. Because only if people are aware of it, then they discuss it first and then they take a decision. And secondly, this is a personal question of leadership. If you are responsible for such a decision, you have to take decisions and you have to address the issue and you have to discuss it. And I tell you, it's very difficult. Because if you start doing it, there is no rule, no paradigms where you can say, oh, so we agree here up to 15 points, but this is 17 points. No, it's a question of taste, it's a question of assessment, it's a question of creativity, of course. Sometimes creative people have to go far, even they have to cross borders. But when is it allowed to cross a border? Or a line in the sand, and where do you have to stop it? There is no rule at all. And I tell you what, this is may be a question of your own responsibility. Give you an example out of music. When I ran Stern magazine, you know, it's a German magazine, I once had a photograph. It was from a dead body in the desert. He was quite dry, obviously. He was in the desert like 100 days, but very much, you know, you could recognize the guy. If you would have been his brother or his mother, you would say, oh, this is Michael, let's say, you know. So we had photographs showing this face, very impressive one, excellent photographs. And you have to make the decision, do I print it or not? And how do I print it? Give me a roll. There is no role at all. You have to make a decision out of your guts, out of your feeling. And the photograph, I decided to do not the close-up. I decided to do a little bit more cautious one because I didn't feel like. The photographer was, you know, he was out of range. He was furious about it because he thought it was the wrong decision. So, but I tell you what, this discussion amongst maybe 20 people took 2 hours. This was maybe a wrong decision, I don't know, but what the best what could happen to people was we discussed it and we made it aware. And the same is true for lyrics we don't accept or we accept or we talk about. And again, if you don't foster this kind of atmosphere and ethical standards, including the freedom of creativity, then you fail. But I don't have any role.
We've got time for a couple more. Yeah, one over there, front row. Thanks.
You talked a lot about what makes a good manager, a bad manager, good CEO, bad CEO. Why is Bertelsmann unhappy with the CEO of Sony BMG? And is it a job that you would entertain going back to running the music business?
How would you know? By reading the press? That Bertelsmann is not happy? Look, I don't refer on Bertelsmann, I don't refer on the current CEO, but if you are in a creative businesses, in a creative business, and you see how creativity develops, you have to care about it immediately. Why? Creative processes take a short time to be destroyed and a long time to be rebuilt. So it's a little bit like a slide on a playground for children, you know. The young kid would sit and say, "Daddy, look, I'm here." And 1 second later, he's in the sand. There's no break in between. And it's a little bit like in the creative businesses. If you're at the edge and if you don't stop it immediately, it goes down very fast and very deep. So this is why every company and every shareholder has to care about. Why do we talk about it? Because BMG, when I took over, was dead. Was basically, you know, the pipeline was empty. And we suffered from this like crazy. And I was genuinely not a music man when I took over BMG. I didn't have any clue about music. And it was maybe the worst time in my life to realize that I'm incompetent in running a music company because I didn't know enough about music. So I have to help myself with other things. And we got it done after all. But I tell you what, it was a pain every other day and week to basically gradually foster and develop and create creativity. It's really difficult. And if you lose it again, we don't like the idea to lose momentum and creative people and artists and executives. And therefore, it's a constant dialogue between shareholders and management about this. It's well, not about one guy and the other. It's a constant dialogue. These guys.
So there's one directly behind that. Yeah.
All the questions we've been asked today have been like confined to the age group like 18 to 30, I would say, like online music or mobile music. Isn't there like a huge market like in the age, like I would say 40 to 60? I mean, I keep hearing my parents complain there are no real new bands like the Rolling Stones or the Beatles. Like, I was just wondering, like, aren't they the kind of people, like, isn't that a huge untapped market where you can basically get any future revenue from, or is the spending power just not there? What do you think?
You mean the 40 to 60?
Yeah.
And also, we're not technically competent to know about burning CDs either, so we like to go and buy stuff.
First of all, you're right. By the way, it's interesting, the country market. Basically, there's no burning, no file sharing in country. Hmm. Country people buy CDs. I love the country people. is there a market for 40 to 60 years? Yes, of course there's a market. Ask Rod Stewart. But we are not producing for 40 to 60 year old people. Why? We would fail. You know, it's not like we're looking for a market niche and produce it to the market niche. It's rubbish. Nobody would do that. We have people who like what they're doing, and they write songs, and we produce songs, and obviously there are a lot of young kids buying music and a lot of kids producing for these kids. But if you look for marketing niche and you would produce for this age, forget about it. I think Carlos Santana, he's in the end of his 50s. He was up and dead and recovered dramatically. He sold 24 million albums 2 albums ago. So he is bought by everybody from, I don't know, from 12 to 80, you know. The idea to target an audience group in age, in music, it doesn't work. You could do it by compilation. You could say the golden 70s, the golden 60s, the golden 80s. Okay, it's fine. But now to write songs for a divorced 52-year-old woman with 2 children, you know, you probably fail.
Now, we never go beyond the time of a CD here. And so we're at 70. I'm going to take we'll have a couple of really quick ones. The guy in the third row, you've had your hand up for a little while, and then I'm going to take you in the orange, and that's it. Okay?
Hello there. Yeah, a couple of months ago, I read a news article on Spike Lee and his comments on the impact of ghetto music on the general population. So my question is regarding your personal opinion on songs, they are peppered with words like, should I mention them here? You know, situations where women are referred to as hoes or things like that, okay? So should the ultimate discretion on choosing this type of music reside in parental control, or does a firm like, you know, Sony BMG actually, you know, has a more active role, you know, to prevent, you know, family institutions from falling apart due to such impacts, as per, you know, the opinions they were expressed by Spike Lee, and that's it.
I hope I got it. You're asking whether we are active in protecting kids like. Pardon me. In protecting kids and or parent control, I didn't.
In protecting kids, for example. Yeah.
So what we do is, if they are, let's say, inappropriate lyrics, we have a sticker on the CDs and say, attention, this is not. These are lyrics. You have to pay attention if you are a parent. So we are making warnings when we feel it's maybe, you know, the parents have to look at it and make a decision. This is what we can do to alert a little bit the kids and the parents if they buy a CD. But before we do that, before we release a record, we obviously care about it. We don't release everything. You know? But if we feel like it's okay, but we have to give a warning, we do that. And this is basically a spread around the industry, and it works quite well, by the way.
Last one, the woman in orange. Yeah.
Hi. Okay, my question is this. I respect the fact that you put such emphasis on content of music, because that's what will give not only the artist, but the relationship that the artist has with the record company and also their relationship with the audience longevity. What I'd like to know is, what on earth is so creative about someone like Britney Spears? It's something that still puzzles me. Yes, she's a cash cow, but does anyone else agree?
You're talking about one of his closest friends here.
Oh, I'm very sorry.
So you obviously love her, right?
Totally.
I can see it. I like her a lot.
I don't know. She puzzles me. Sorry, that's all I have to say.
You better go home and burn a couple of her CDs and see how it turns.
Look, let's be serious here. What's wrong with an artist who attracts millions of kids by singing songs? We are not in an elite business. We are in a business where we want to reach audience. And if Britney sings and millions of kids like it because they like their singing, they like maybe their beauty, that's okay. We are not in a business where anybody like a CEO takes decisions on the basis of his taste. This is a kind of censorship I would not agree with, by the way. This would be, by the way, the most boring music company you have ever seen if I decided about the content. You know? And therefore, I love Britney.
Look, Rolf has better go and have some dinner, and you've all got to get back to the library. So thank you very much. It's been very interesting.